Chapter 18. The Resistance Movement. Latiman professed to have discovered some new patent powder, Pimper Limp Limp, a single pinch of which, being thrown into each corner of a field, will kill every bug throughout its whole extent, and people will listen to him with attention and respect. But tell them of any simple, common-sense plan based upon correct scientific principles to check and keep within reasonable bounds the insect foes of the farmer, and they will laugh you to scorn. Benjamin Walsh, The Practical Entomologist, 1866. All summer long, messengers from Federal Express deliver large white parcels to a laboratory down on Moffett Sea Level. The parcels come from hamlets in Louisiana, Southern California, and many other states in between, the swath of North America that is often called the Cotton Belt or the Bible Belt. As these parcels come in, a postdoc in the laboratory sets them on his lab bench, slits the FedEx seals, and lifts the insulated lids. Inside, each box is molded in the shape of a white crater. In the bottom of the crater, lying on a bed of dry ice, amid a faint rising cloud of vapor, are a dozen gray moths. The postdoc, Martin Taylor, lifts out the moths one by one with the tweezers. One by one, he grinds them in a mortar and pestle, like an old-fashioned pharmacist, to extract their DNA. He is watching these moths from his laboratory bench, the way Peter Boag is watching Darwin's finches. Some of the greatest opposition to evolution comes from the farmers of the Cotton Belt, and that is where Taylor is seeing one of the most dramatic cases of evolution in action on this planet. There was a time, not so long ago, when this particular species of moth, Heliothus virescens, lived a life of obscurity, probably in forests and hedgerows where it ate weeds. But in the year 1940, cotton farmers began spraying their fields with the chemical compound dichlorodiphenyl trichloroethane, better known as DDT. These first insecticidal sprays killed so many insects and killed so many of the birds that ate the insects that in biological terms, the cotton fields were left standing virtually vacant, like an archipelago of newborn islands. And out of the woods and hedgerows fluttered Heliothus virescens. Some of these moths were able to tolerate DDT. They lived long enough to lay their eggs in the cotton bolls. Their eggs hatched into larvae, and the larvae began devouring the cotton. In the next few optimistic years, pesticide manufacturers assaulted Heliothus with bigger and bigger doses of DDT. They also brought out more poisons from the same chemical family, aldrin chlordane. The aim was nothing less than the control of nature, and pesticide manufacturers believed that control was within their grasp. The annual introduction of new pesticides rose from the very first product, DDT, in 1940, to great waves of chemical invention in the 1960s and 1970s. In those decades, dozens of new herbicides and insecticides were brought to market each year. Heliothus became one of the most heavily sprayed species in what amounted to a biological world war. Through it all, the moths clung to the cotton. At the moment, most farmers in the Cotton Belt are spraying their fields with pyrethroids, which are sold under brand names as optimistic as ever. Two of the more popular are Scout and Karate. When these pyrethroids were first introduced, they improved cotton yields by about a quarter, sometimes as much as a third. But in the year 1980, there were reports from California's Imperial Valley of moths with 50-fold resistance to pyrethroids. This resistance movement spread like the others. Right now, Heliothus is throwing the cotton industry in Louisiana in a panic, says Bruce Black, an entomologist at American Cyanamid, the pesticide giant which is based in Princeton. The moths have become almost absolutely resistant to all pesticides, from your cyclodienes to your organophosphates to your carbamates and most of your pyrethroids. And these pyrethroids are literally the last bastion to prevent the cotton industry from collapsing. In Louisiana, in the fields, They have insects that are 200-fold resistant to pyrethroids. Farmers are saying they can't grow a crop next year. The bugs will wipe them out. Martin Taylor has a grant from American Cyanamid to watch Heliothus evolve. When he lectures about Heliothus, Taylor usually begins with a transparency on which he has printed in tall, spindly Victorian characters, the variation of animals and plants under domestication, with special reference to resistance of insects to pesticides, by Charles Darwin, M.A., F.R.S., etc. It's an extraordinarily potent example of evolution going on under our eyes, Taylor says, visible evolution. A pesticide applies selection pressure as surely as a drought or flood. The poison selects against traits that make a species vulnerable to it, because the individuals that are most vulnerable are the ones that die first. The poison selects for any trait that makes the species less vulnerable, because the least vulnerable are the ones that survive longest and leave the most offspring. In this way, the invention of pesticides in the 20th century has driven waves of evolution in insects all over the planet. Heliothus is only one case in hundreds. Flying scale insects have evolved strong resistance to buquinolate in only 6 generations. Nematode worms in the guts of sheep have evolved strong resistance to thiabendazole in 3 generations. Sheep ticks have evolved strong resistance to HCH dieldrin in just 2 generations. In 1967, a distinguished entomologist announced in Scientific American the discovery of a resistance-proof family of insecticides. The poisons were variants of some of the insects' hormones. How could insects escape their own hormones? Yet within 5 years, flies had evolved 100-fold resistance. This seemed to surprise people, says Taylor. It would not have surprised an evolutionary biologist, but it surprised pesticide sprayers and the manufacturers of chemical compounds endlessly. If you look through the literature, says Linda Hall of Cornell University, who specializes in the study of pesticide resistance, you'll find people saying, resistance will not develop for pyrethroids. That was incredibly naive. Almost anything you give an insect, almost any way you find to kill it, it will find a way not to be killed. That's the whole bit about evolution. No matter what you choose for your killing method, it will find a way not to be killed. Yet people from various companies were standing up at American Chemical Society meetings and saying, insects should not develop resistance to pyrethroids. I don't know, she says. I don't understand it at all. When evolutionists study these worldwide resistance movements, they see 4 classes of adaptations arising, because an insect under attack has 4 possible routes to survival. First, it can simply dodge. Strains of malarial mosquitoes in Africa used to fly into a hut, sting someone, and then land on the hut wall to digest their meals. In the 1950s and 1960s, health workers began spraying hut walls with DDT. Unfortunately, in every village, there were always a few mosquitoes that would fly in through the window, bite, and fly right back out. Millions of mosquitoes died, but these few survived and multiplied. Within a short time, almost all of the mosquitoes in the villages were hit-and-run mosquitoes. Second, if an insect cannot dodge, it can evolve a way to keep the poison from getting under its cuticle. Some diamondback moths, if they land on a leaf that is tainted with pyrethroids, will fly off and leave their poisoned legs behind, an adaptive trick known as leg drop. Third, if the insect can't keep the poison out, it may evolve an antidote. A mosquito species called Culex pipiens can now survive massive doses of organophosphate insecticides. The mosquitoes actually digest the poison using a suite of enzymes known as esterases. The genes that make these esterases are known as alleles B1 and B2. Many strains of Culex pipiens now carry as many as 250 copies of the B1 allele and 60 copies of B2. Because these genes are virtually identical, letter by letter, from continent to continent, it seems likely that they come from a single lucky mosquito. The mutant, the founder of this particular resistance movement, is thought to have lived in the 1960s somewhere in Africa or Asia. Its descendants apparently hitched rides around the world in airplanes. The genes first appeared in Californian mosquitoes in 1984, in Italian mosquitoes in 1985, and in French mosquitoes in 1986. Finally, if the insect can't evolve an antidote, it can sometimes find an internal dodge. The poison has a target somewhere inside the insect's body. The insect can shrink this target, or move it, or lose it. Of the four types of adaptations, the four survival strategies, this is the hardest for evolution to bring off. But Taylor thinks this is how Heliothus is evolving now. It always seems amazing to me that evolutionists pay so little attention to this kind of thing, says Taylor, and that cotton growers are having to deal with these pests in the very states whose legislatures are so hostile to the theory of evolution, because it is evolution itself they are struggling against in their fields each season. These people are trying to ban the teaching of evolution while their own cotton crops are failing because of evolution. How can you be a creationist farmer anymore? Heliothus can evolve resistance to pyrethroids in the course of a single growing season. In Arkansas in May 1987, only about 6% of the moths survived a certain fixed dose of the poison. But by that September, several moth generations later, 61% survived that same dose. The same rapid evolution has been observed in cotton fields in Louisiana, Oklahoma, Texas, and Mississippi. Years ago, when DDT resistance first appeared, geneticists studied the problem in the laboratory with houseflies. Flies that survived doses of DDT often carried a certain mutant gene on the third chromosome, a mutant that came to be called KDR for knockdown resistance. This single gene conferred resistance to DDT and all its variants. Today, every postmodern, well-equipped housefly carries not only KDR, but also a mutant gene called PEN, which reduces its uptake of insecticides. On the fly's fourth chromosome, it carries a mutant gene called DLD-R, which gives it resistance to Dieldrin and Dieldrin's family of poisons. On its second chromosome, it carries a mutant gene known as ACHE-R, which protects it from organophosphates and carbamates. Flies were astonishingly quick to evolve resistance to pyrethroids, and many investigators think they coped so well because they had already evolved in the right direction with DDT. The same KDR that fought DDT seems to have fought pyrethroids too. If a lucky fly's parents both carry KDR, so that it inherits one copy from the mother and one copy from the father, it will often display 1,000-fold resistance to pyrethroids. According to current thinking, DDT and pyrethroids both attack the same target in the fly, microscopic doorways in the membranes of the fly's nerve cells. These doorways, sodium channels, open and close to allow nerve signals to pass through the cell. Both DDT and pyrethroids are thought to jam the channels open, triggering repetitive, uncontrolled discharges in the nerve cells. If enough of the channels get locked open, a fly goes into convulsions, then paralysis, and dies. The structure of the sodium channel is almost identical in animals as far apart on the evolutionary tree as flies, eels, rats, and human beings. This suggests that the structure evolved far back in evolutionary time, before the split in the tree between invertebrates and vertebrates. In the sodium channel, then, the poison is attacking a structure that is old, vital, and universally fixed in its design throughout the animal kingdom. One would think it would be extremely hard for a fly to change such a venerable design. But flies have done just that. They have modified the genes that make the channels in a way that somehow saves the flies from the jamming action of the poison. The sodium channel gene has been completely sequenced in Drosophila melanogaster. That is, all of the invisible characters that make up the gene have been deciphered and published. So Taylor and his advisor, Mary Kreitman, decided on a hunch to go into the DNA of the moth and look for the same gene. Although the Heliothus genome is unusually big for an insect, it is bigger than a chicken's, approaching the size of a human being's, a billion letters long. Taylor knew exactly how to go about finding the gene. With the new molecular techniques, the procedure is reasonably easy to do. The Drosophila gene goes ATC, GAG, AAG, TAC, TTC, GT, GT, and so on. Taylor went to a small machine along the wall of the laboratory, a DNA synthesizer, which is standard equipment for a molecular evolutionist. Standing at this synthesizer, as nonchalantly as if he were typing on a keyboard, he instructed the machine to assemble the matching sequence of letters, a fragment of artificial DNA. Then he ground up bits and pieces of Heliothus moths in a mortar and pestle, extracted the moth's DNA, and mixed in the artificial DNA. If the moth did carry the same gene as the fly, Taylor's DNA fragment would find it and bind to it. The small strand of artificial DNA would stick to the long strand of moth DNA. To see if they did stick together, he bathed all of the DNA in a special enzyme solution, which chopped the strands into pieces, and he sifted through the pieces. "It's all very robust stuff, DNA," Taylor says. "You can do all this grinding and it won't break. The only risks to it are from enzymes." After months of work, Taylor found a fragment in the genome of the moth that matched part of the gene in the fly. The moth gene went ATC, GAG, AAG, TAC, TTC, GT, GT, and so on for 184 of Darwin's invisible characters. Almost 200 letters, and they differed by only a single letter between Heliothus and Drosophila. The moth carries almost exactly the same gene as the fly. Now Taylor is searching through the moth's sodium channel gene for changes that might protect the moth from pyrethroids. Which letters have flipped along the length of the DNA and saved the day for Heliothus? This part of the search is much more laborious. It may take as little as a single letter flip, a single point substitution, as it is called, to make the moth resist the poison. And the whole gene consists of many thousands of letters. Yet the pesticide manufacturers once thought they would wipe out pests once and for all with pyrethroids. "People don't like to have their categories threatened," says Taylor. "They like to think, that's a moth and that's a fly, fixed categories. They don't like to think of lots of hybridizing and change all the time in every line of moths and flies, lots of evolution in action all the time around them. Even people who think they understand Darwin tend not to think about this because they are schooled in Darwin's gradualism. It is hard enough to control pests, even if we know what is going on. But you can't control them if you don't realize the target you are aiming at can move." Because we do not think this way, we make the same tactical errors again and again. Resistance movements are not only out in the cotton fields, they are also closer to home. During the past 50 years, while we have been throwing poisons at the pests in our fields, we have also been throwing larger and larger quantities of chemicals at the pests within our own bodies. Here, too, scientists are now watching evolution in action. Western hospitals started to use antibiotics regularly in the 1950s, and resistance appeared within a year or two. One out of three patients in every Western hospital is now on antibiotics, and antibiotic resistance is increasing so rapidly that many physicians are calling it a global epidemic. This kind of resistance tends to follow the same cycle as pesticide resistance. Big companies, big medicine, blanket treatment, followed by almost immediate disappointment. "It's generally the case that these chemical companies are not familiar with evolution," says Martin Taylor. In the U.S., the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDCP, in Atlanta, has instituted a national surveillance for drug resistance. When these new drug resistance strains become endemic in hospitals, one doctor told the editor of Science recently, "you will be safer staying home than going to a hospital unless you have a truly dread disease." It is easy to start a resistance movement in the most common bacteria in the human gut, E. coli. First, one establishes a colony of E. coli in a petri dish. The bacteria multiply so rapidly that a single microscopic cell can grow into a visible pile of 10 million E. coli between morning and mid-afternoon. To the eye, 10 million E. coli look like a tiny heap of salt. Next, one doses the colony with an antibiotic. As fast as it grew, the colony disappears. Only a few cells in the colony have survived, the two or three cells that carry a rare resistance gene for that antibiotic. These several survivors multiply and pass their successful gene to their descendants. Soon there is a new colony in the dish, a colony in which virtually every member cell is resistant to the antibiotic. Darwin would have loved to watch that simple experiment, says one molecular evolutionist. That's exactly what he said natural selection is, and it can happen in a day or two. Bruce Levin, a microbiologist who is now at Emory University in Atlanta, once teamed up with several colleagues to watch the evolution of E. coli in his own gut. Every few days when he went to the John, he would take a sample. A single wipe of toilet paper comes away with as many as 2 trillion individuals of the Bacteroid species, 20 billion individual enterobacteria, and dozens of other species that have never been named by science. The investigators followed Levin's E. coli for almost a year. They found that the ecology of his gut was hectic, eclectic, and tumultuous. Strains of E. coli kept appearing and disappearing. In the course of the experiment, the microbiologists identified a total of 53 different strains, all but two of which went rapidly extinct. These strains of bacteria were apparently colonizing Levin like birds in the Galapagos. The strains were flying in on the food he ate, and on every touch from his wife, their two children, their dog and cat, a group that a commentator in Nature dubbed the Levin Archipelago. In these bacterial cells, the DNA is not locked away in a walled nucleus. Instead, it floats free in a long necklace of DNA, a circle of about 10,000 genes. Other smaller necklaces float about within the cell too, rings of DNA called plasmids. A typical E. coli individual holds two or three plasmids. Dozens of these plasmids can move among different species of bacteria like secret battle codes written in Darwin's invisible ink. Some of their genes can actually jump from the plasmid and insert themselves into the main necklace, or eject themselves completely from the cell and enter another bacterial cell, like letters without envelopes. When bacteria are under stress, for instance when their human host takes an antibiotic, the cells use their jumping genes to pass resistance genes back and forth at a great rate. "We did a study," Levin says. "How fast can evolution proceed in a human? My wife took ampicillin. I took erythromycin. Within a few days, we were both dominated by resistant bacteria. Not only was tetracycline resistance coming up, but also streptomycin, kanamycin, carbamazepine. Our bacteria were going from almost nothing to multiple resistance in an amazingly short amount of time. If you did it in a test tube, you wouldn't be surprised. But to take a couple of pills and see it happen inside you is really kind of awesome. It gives you an eerie feeling. When we talk about natural selection, we're not talking about eons here. It's not just dead dinosaurs." Resistance is now growing in gonorrhea, streptococcus, tuberculosis, salmonella. In the United States, the incidence of the bacterium Neisseria gonorrhoeae with resistance to penicillin more than tripled between the years 1988 and 1990. In 1990, an outbreak of fatal dysentery struck Burundi, and the microbes were resistant to every single oral antibiotic in the country. Local resistance movements like these can get carried around the world and plunge millions of people into epidemics. In principle, this is nothing new. Measles traveled the caravan routes of the Roman Empire from AD 165 to AD 180. Smallpox followed the same routes in AD 251 to 266. And one in three people along the caravan routes died. But today, the caravan routes are mostly airborne, and Concords are faster than camels. A new virus or bacterium can circle the earth in a matter of days. In 1941, 10,000 units of penicillin administered four times a day for 4 days cured patients of pneumococcal pneumonia, writes the physician Harold New of Columbia University. Today, a patient could receive 24 million units of penicillin a day and still die of the disease. Bacteria are cleverer than men. Not long ago, reading the headlines in a front-page newspaper story about drug resistance, a molecular evolutionist stopped at the word inordinately. The headline said that bacteria in some hospitals are inordinately resistant to penicillin. Well, he said, they're not inordinately resistant to it, they're completely resistant to it. There might as well not be penicillin there. Considering the shortness of the time span, the number of mechanistically different countermoves that bacteria have invented against antibacterial agents is amazing, writes Alexander Tomas of Rockefeller University. These cells have evolved an appalling arsenal of weapons against penicillin and its large family of antibiotics. They have evolved anti-antibiotic enzymes to match every antibiotic that is being thrown at them. All these chemical weapons and counterweapons, says Tomas, match one another as defensive and offensive weapons match in classical warfare. Shield against the arrow, bazooka against the tank. There are now drugs designed to attack the bacteria's resistance to antibiotics. Anti-antibiotics. And much of this high-technology war has evolved in the lifetime of doctors now in practice. The amazing degree of variation in some kinds of resistance, writes Tomas, suggests that these resistance traits are continuing to evolve under our very eyes. As with pesticides, investigators are now tracking the evolution of antibiotic resistance at the level of DNA. The core of anti-tuberculosis regimens is a drug known as isoniazid. Recently, investigators looked at strains of Mycobacterium tuberculosis isolated from two patients. They found that in each strain, the bacteria had dropped from its chromosome a gene called CATG, which codes for the production of two enzymes, catalase and peroxidase. In the laboratory, the investigators isolated a strain of bacteria that lacked this gene. The strain produced very little of these two enzymes and was resistant to isoniazid. Into this strain, the investigators inserted the missing gene CATG. Instantly, the strain started manufacturing the two enzymes, but it was now killed by isoniazid. Apparently, the cells had paid a price to defend themselves from the drug. They had made an evolutionary trade-off, giving up part of their own adaptive equipment for the sake of survival. The bacillus got rid of an Achilles heel by evolving a heel-less foot. Each year, about 8 million people are colonized by this adaptive bacillus, Mycobacterium tuberculosis. About 1 in 3 people on the planet already carry it, and each of them has about 1 chance in 10 of developing the symptoms. In the developing world, the disease accounts for almost 7% of all deaths. In the United States in the 1980s, tuberculosis had been in retreat for a century. Doctors and the directors of public health programs thought of it as a defeated disease. They looked away. Between 1985 and 1992, tuberculosis increased in incidence by nearly 20%. The number of cases among children born in the United States under the age of 5 rose 30% just between the years 1987 and 1990. As two physicians observe in a review of the disease and its resurgence, the principal risk behavior for acquiring TB infection is breathing. Physicians can watch the human immune system attack invaders, and they can watch the bacteria and viruses dodge and twist. F. McFarlane Burnett, who won the Nobel Prize for his work in immunology, called this evolution made visible. Teams of investigators are now watching the evolution of AIDS in the living bodies of individual patients. Intensive studies of this kind have been conducted in England, the United States, and Africa. Viruses are the first organisms on the planet whose genetic sequences have been read and published from beginning to end. The complete nucleotide sequence of one strain of the AIDS virus, HIV-1, is 9,749 base pairs long. But this sequence does not stand still because the virus has no proofreaders. When investigators take a series of samples from an individual patient, they see rapid evolution. Individual letters in the sequence change, clusters of letters change, whole chunks of DNA disappear, while other chunks insert themselves in new places along the strand. A human body with AIDS is like an entire Galapagos archipelago. It harbors an increasingly diverse group of viruses after the first one has invaded it. the first virus particle to invade evolves into a swarm of variant strains. In the AIDS virus, the gene known as ENV is the one that evolves fastest. ENV codes for the envelope of the virus, which is what the human immune system tries to grasp and destroy. The ENV gene changes about a million times faster than the normal mutation rate of its host, the human body. In this way, according to present thinking, it keeps eluding the grasp of the immune system. In a sense, the weapon of the virus is variation itself. The influenza virus also evolves rapidly. The sequence of the human flu virus changes at a rate of more than 2 letters a year. It can evolve even faster if it happens to meet up with a virus that infects horses, pigs, or seagulls. Very often, the strains meet when they both happen to infect the body of the same pig. There, they not only give the pig the flu, they also swap genes. They hybridize, and the new virus is sometimes changed enough to evade the attacks of the human immune system and sweep the world. So far, despite all our plagues, we have been lucky. In principle, a random mutation or a hybridization event could someday create a virus that combines the airborne, infectious qualities of flu and the deadly, long-latency, slow-killing qualities of AIDS. It hasn't happened yet, but there is nothing in Darwin's process to prevent it. And the larger the pool of human beings on the planet, the more viruses are jumping in. Our only real competition for domination of the planet remains the viruses, the microbiologist Joshua Lederberg once said. The survival of humanity, he added, is not preordained. Resistance movements can spring up and overwhelm us even within the lines of our own cells. A cell that turns cancerous is a cell that has escaped the molecular restraints that keep most of our cells from multiplying out of control. When doctors hit a colony of these cells with drugs, radiation, or heat, a few of the cells may resist the attack. With cancer, when you are in chemotherapy, you get resistance, says Bruce Levin. You are seeing the very same problem in yourself. Most of the cells of a tumor are typically killed by the first doses of chemicals, but those that survive can proliferate. The rapidly growing cells, it behooves them to avoid being killed, says Levin. It's no different from putting streptomycin into a bacterial culture. Talk about evolution in action, you're seeing evolution at home. Of course, that's the last thing on your mind. All this is a simple corollary to Darwinian law. Wherever we aim at a species point blank, for whatever reason, we drive its evolution, often in the opposite direction from what we ourselves desire. The law holds, whatever our reason for shooting at a species, and whether the species is submicroscopic or gigantic. In the late 1970s and early 1980s, between 10% and 20% of all the elephants in the wild were being killed each year. At that rate, wild elephants would have gone extinct by the end of the century. This was an intense selection event. For poachers, elephants with big tusks were prime targets. Elephants with small tusks were more likely to be passed over, and those with no tusks were not shot. In effect, though no one realized it at the time, African elephants in places where poaching was rife were under enormous selection pressure for tusklessness. And in fact, elephant watchers in the most heavily poached areas began noticing more and more tuskless elephants in the wild. Andrew Dobson, an ecologist at Princeton, has compiled graphs of this trend, tracing the evolution of tusklessness in 5 African wildlife preserves: Amboseli, Mikumi, Tsavo East, Tsavo West, and Queen Elizabeth. In Amboseli, where the elephants are relatively safe, the proportion of tuskless female elephants is small, just a few percent. But in Mikumi, a park where the elephants are heavily poached, tusklessness is rising. The longer each generation lives, the fewer tusks the elephants carry. Among females aged 5 through 10, about 10% are tuskless. Among females aged 30 to 35, about 50% are tuskless. Male elephants use their tusks to fight one another over females. When most males are tusked, a male without them is like a knight without a lance. But where fewer and fewer males sport tusks, the untusked male has a fighting chance of getting a harem and passing on his tuskless genes. He is more and more fit. These are evolutionary changes, and no matter what happens in the future, the balance of genes will work itself out for many generations and many centuries, if elephants live that long. This same sort of evolutionary change is also taking place in the world's seas. Most sport fishermen and commercial fisheries follow a basic rule: keep the big ones and throw back the little ones. That, too, is an evolutionary pressure. A net is a powerful agent of Darwinian selection. In one recent laboratory demonstration, investigators raised water fleas in aquarium tanks. Every 4 days, they sieved the tanks with fine meshed nets. In one set of tanks, they threw back the little fleas and killed the big ones. In another set of tanks, they threw back the big fleas and killed the little ones. They kept this up for generations of water fleas, and they saw a dramatic evolutionary response. In the tanks where they culled the small fleas, the fleas began growing faster and delaying the age of first reproduction. Fleas that put all their energy and resources into growing fast had the best chance to escape the net. They saved the act of reproduction, which is expensive in terms of time and resources even for a flea, until they were older, bigger, and safer. But in the tanks where the big fleas were killed, evolution ran the opposite course. There the water fleas grew slowly and began reproducing when they were still small. For those fleas, it was the one that stayed small longest that lived longest and passed on the most genes. John Endler has seen the same kind of evolutionary responses among his guppies, both in the wild and in the laboratory. Some guppy eaters like their guppies big, and some like them small, and they too drive the evolution of their prey. The changes are predictable and rapid. They take about 50 guppy generations. In the world's oceans, Norwegian cod, Chinook salmon, Atlantic salmon, red snapper, and red porgy are getting smaller, very likely through the selection pressures of the net. Fishermen are not happy with the trend toward small fish any more than elephant poachers are pleased with the trend toward tusklessness. But both resistance movements are direct results of Darwinian law. Working late? Asks one of the lab assistants. As usual, Taylor says. He is wearing 2 days' worth of black stubble, a scruffy black turtleneck, and a slightly disreputable shade of gray in his face. I don't know why you bother to keep an apartment, says the assistant. You're always here. You might as well just string up a hammock. Might as well, he says. It is past midnight, and Taylor is grinding away, but the moths are evolving much faster than he can keep up with them. They are growing more and more resistant in Australia and also in the United States, mostly west of Alabama. Apparently, there is more than one gene involved in their resistance movement. The sodium channel may be only the beginning of the story. Meanwhile, most cotton farmers are still spraying pesticides routinely, often before any pests show up, a practice known as insurance spraying or spray and pray. So the selection pressures on Heliothus and the other pests in the cotton fields, including the notorious boll weevil, continue to be intense, and the pests keep evolving more and more resistance. As more and more developing countries turn from DDT to pyrethroids, they are likely to provoke precisely the same evolutionary events, the same evolution of KDR and the same control failure. The chances of success of each new pesticide under development keep dropping, and the costs of development keep rising. One expert wonders whether we have already selected in pests the genes they need to evolve resistance to practically any toxicant that may be used against them. The answer, he adds fatalistically, will be provided in time by the pests themselves. Before human beings had heaped up a mountain of pesticides in the 1940s, when we were still in the foothills of this evolutionary adventure, farmers in the United States were losing about 7% of their crops to insects. During the blitz of the 1970s and 1980s, the insects did not lose any ground. Instead, they nearly doubled their share to 13%. Indeed, note the ecologists Robert May and Andrew Dobson, the fraction of all crops lost to pests in the United States today has changed little from that in medieval Europe, where it was said that of every 3 grains grown, one was lost to pests, leaving one for next year's seed and one to eat. May and Dobson believe this global evolutionary disaster may help to show that evolution is not some scholarly abstraction, but rather is a reality that has undermined and will continue to undermine any control program that fails to take account of evolutionary processes. Meanwhile, the 10 least wanted microbes in the world today, from enterobacteria to streptococcus, are now resistant to almost everything we can throw at them. Drug companies are bringing out only a few new drugs against them each year, a process that costs about $200 million per drug, and each new drug often takes as much as 7 years to bring to market. Harold New of Columbia says it is now critical for doctors, patients, and drug companies to avoid all unnecessary use of antibiotics for humans or animals, because this selective pressure has been what has brought us to this crisis. What we don't understand on either front is that the more pressure we put on our pests, the more we cause them to evolve around the pressure. The pressure is evolutionary pressure. What we fail to understand is evolution itself. Evolution is not just the Galapagos and not just out there beyond the window pane, buffeting the robin and the oak. Evolution is a very near thing. To us, it is a terrible irony. Precisely where we wish to control the environment most tightly and possess it most completely, we are powerless to do so, besieged and beleaguered by resistance movements that seem to spring up faster the more we lop them off, like the heads of Hydra. The harder we fight these resistance movements, the harder and faster they evolve before our eyes, precisely because it is our effort at control that is driving their evolution. What we call control is to them merely a change in the environment, just another change in an endless series of changes. And they are superbly placed and designed to keep up with such changes. As long as we keep up the pressure indiscriminately, they will continue to rise in plagues against us, like the frogs that came up on the land of Egypt, or the dust of the earth that became lice throughout all the land of Egypt. Right, Taylor says in the voice of midnight, as he lifts another moth from its crater of ice and holds it up with his tweezers. Hey, what's your trick? He drops it in the bottom of a clear plastic vial. It looks out of place lying there, surrounded by the whirling centrifuges and chirping Geiger counters of the laboratory, like an African mask on the wall of a sleek modern art gallery. Taylor fusses with his preparations. It's very, tedious, he mutters. He picks up a glass rod to grind a bit of the moth in the bottom of the vial. Not yet resistant to the pestle, he says.